It's the first Monday of March. Time to check in with legislative leadership at the State House. All eyes are on Augusta today, specifically on Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. He's expected to announce whether supporters of ranked choice voting have enough signatures for an historic people's veto, and in turn, whether Maine voters will use a new voting system for this year's primary elections. And supporters of Medicaid expansion are watching the legislature to see if the projected $130 million in surplus revenue will be used to pay for Medicaid expansion. Recreational marijuana advocates are frustrated that everything seems to be in flux when it comes to creating a licensing system, and the governor continues to propose major bills. I'm Maine Public Statehouse reporter Mal Leary. Today, we'll discuss those issues and more. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Mal Leary, and this is Maine Calling. The Maine legislature continues to churn away at the end of the session, we think, is slowly coming into view. Today, we're going to hear about the latest bills up for debate and their chance for passage. With me is Amy Volk. She's a Republican from Scarborough and is Assistant Senate Majority Leader. Nate Libby's a Democrat from Lewiston and is Assistant Senate Minority Leader. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the latest happenings here at the Capitol? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Let's talk about all of those bills that are coming in at the last moment. Some of them are issues that have been around with us for a long time. Ranked choice voting, the Secretary of State's ruling today on whether they have the signatures. Is that not going to pose some significant problems to the legislature in this last 6 or 7 weeks? Amy, as folks try to figure out how this is going to play out in a primary election that's just a few weeks later.
Absolutely. We certainly have major concerns about the rollout of ranked choice voting and whether or not we can assure the integrity of our elections, considering that we'll have to transport ballots likely to the Secretary of State's office, and all of these ballots will be somehow tabulated by hand. It's my understanding that this can get extremely complicated at the state level. Municipalities, when they hold these types of elections, you're dealing with obviously a much smaller number of ballots that have to be calculated. We are talking about thousands and thousands of ballots. So it's going to be very interesting, bit of an experiment, potentially.
And Nate, the legislature, as I understand it, has yet to appropriate the money. The Secretary of State says he's going to need to implement all of this process if indeed it goes forward and we have the ranked choice voting in place for the primary. Is that likely to happen? That's always a question mark around here, is passing a budget bill.
Right. The last time the legislature took action on this issue, it was to push out implementation for a few years. That was passed by slim majorities in the Senate and the House. I think now, though, the dynamic has changed so that we actually have a ranked choice election on the horizon in June. Perhaps colleagues in the other party will be interested in actually answering these questions of how we're going to pay for this new system and potentially addressing some of the logistical concerns around transporting all these ballots to one location. This is definitely going to be an experiment, but the voters pass this at the ballot box. It's treated like any other law that we pass here in the legislature, in my opinion.
This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. We want to hear your questions for some of our leaders in the legislature at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Some good news last week as the revenue reforecasting folks came in. A lot of extra money kicking around. What's that money going to be used for? A lot of folks are saying it could be used for expanding Medicaid that the voters approved. Nate, is that a good use of that money?
Well, I think we have to separate the Medicaid question from the revenue surplus question. Our estimates show that we need about $30 million to expand Medicaid under the provisions of the law that was passed by voters last year. The Medicaid account has $800 million sitting in it right now. We feel that the governor has the statute laid out in front of him, and it's on him to implement the expansion of Medicaid starting on July 2nd with enrolling new enrollees, folks that are eligible for health insurance. When it comes to the surplus, we've got about $140 million over budget projections. And when we enacted the budget last year, we knew that we were leaving certain priorities on the table unfunded. A few of those priorities that come to my mind are nursing homes, for example, folks that provide behavioral health treatment, as another example, our county correctional system that needs to have a shortfall addressed. There are a number of priorities that we did not take care of in the last budget, and I think the revenue surplus provides us an opportunity to make sure we can fill those needs.
Amy, there's always more requests for spending than there is money to fill it. But when the voters have approved something, doesn't that give it a little extra boost when you're negotiating the budget in those last few days of the session?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I would agree with Senator Libby that that's a little bit of a separate issue and that we should really be prioritizing those items that we left unfunded in the second year of the budget. And there are a lot of them. It was part of the budget agreement that was the result of a three-day shutdown at state government. And so, you know, unfortunately, what that looked like was a lot of holes in the second year. We need to get those holes patched, and then we do have some issues. And I think that if we could fund some of the issues that Senator Libby just mentioned, that might also go toward alleviating some of the wait lists that give the governor a lot of angst and, you know, honestly, a lot of us a lot of angst. You know, we continue to hear a lot about mental illness in the state, and yet we have people with mental illness that are on wait lists for services, as well as people with developmental disabilities, people on the autism spectrum, things like that. So I would really like to see us take care of those folks, ensure that they're getting the services that they're entitled to, that they've been waiting sometimes many years for, and then take a look at, you know, how can we go about implementing Medicaid expansion. I agree. When the voters have passed something, we need to look at, you know, whether or not that can be implemented. And I think certainly now, given the position of the Trump administration, we have an opportunity to look at what was passed across the country under some conservative governors and how those conservative states are continuing to adjust the system and putting accountability, personal responsibility into the system to ensure that it is protected from as much abuse as possible. You know, but it, again, that really is it's on the governor's desk, so to speak, at the department, and it's really up to him to move ahead. It's my understanding it's only about $2.2 million of hires that he would have to do in this particular year. And then I think, as Senator Libby said, it would be another $30 million going forward. So, but, you know, I understand not wanting to see an increase in taxes on Maine people. I understand wanting to be able to pass along savings and make sure that our residents are not hit as a result of the tax conformity. So the relief on the federal side, we find actually results in an increase in taxes being paid by Mainers on the state side. And so I know the governor's tax conformity package is looking to alleviate that. So, you know, we've got all those things to talk about between now and the end of session. And as you know, we only have a little over a month.
Nate, another issue that the voters have put on your laps to resolve is recreational marijuana. And they passed that a year ago last fall. The legislature still hasn't been able to put together a package of licensing requirements to implement that law. Why is it taking so long for this to get done when the voters wanted it passed a year ago in November?
Right. So this is one that when I explain it to my constituents, they kind of say, oh, okay, well, that makes little sense. So the voters passed, 50-some pages of state statute when they voted simply yes or no on marijuana legalization. But behind that question, that single question, was 50 or 60 pages of new regulations. And so when we set about our work a year ago, we were determined to go line by line through every single regulation that was developed by the professional recreational industry to make sure that we're providing the proper check on that industry. That work has taken some time. The subcommittee that was leading the charge on this developed a proposal, a refined version of what was passed by the voters that I think struck the right balance between public safety and our kids in schools, law enforcement, treatment, all those sorts of things. Legislature passed that that version last fall. It was vetoed, and the veto was not overridden in the House of Representatives. So the Subcommittee on Legalization has taken another crack at it. I think they're going to produce a new version, a version that they think may solicit enough support in the House Republican caucus and get a signature from Governor LePage. But I think they're trying to give it one more shot and see if they can make good on what the voters passed when they said yes to legalization.
Amy, is this a reflection of how close the vote was in the first place? The legislature still is pretty equally divided on mm-hmm. the question of whether we should have recreational marijuana, even though the voters did indeed enact that legislation.
Well, in some ways, but I would actually say I think it highlights more the issues with the referendum process in general, because as Senator Libby just said, it really was the commercializers who are going to make a profit off of legal recreational marijuana that wrote the law and promoted the law, paid for all of the advertising. It's very hard to get people to contribute to a campaign against something. And I don't know the exact figures, but I know that those in favor of passing the referendum dramatically outspent those in favor of opposing the referendum. And that's pretty standard issue in terms of Maine's referendum questions. So unfortunately, we end up with a law that was written by the people who were going to profit off of the law. And it then goes to the legislature to figure out what works and what doesn't work. In this case, there was an awful lot that did not work, that did not make any sense whatsoever. And then I think we also have a governor who, probably does not want to be the governor that legalizes marijuana in the state of Maine. So, I know Senator Libby graciously just suggested that the governor might sign it. I would be shocked if he did that. I think, he may allow it to go into law without his signature. I will be shocked if Paul LePage puts his signature to a bill to legalize marijuana in the state of Maine. There's a lot of law enforcement people that have major, major, major concerns around legal recreation. There are a lot of employers that have major concerns around legal recreational marijuana. Not saying it's not going to happen. I think it is going to happen. But I think we have to take the time to write the policy correctly, look at what other states that have legal recreational marijuana have done, adjust that for Maine's culture and Maine's rural nature, and determine what works best for us. We were not able to meet the standard in the first go-around of getting that two-thirds vote to overcome a veto, so back to the drawing board they went. They've worked really hard, this particular group of people, all of whom serve on other committees as well. They met all summer long, I believe. So they deserve a lot of credit. It's not lack of action. It's the fact that the referendum itself was a disaster. And it needed to be completely overhauled. And we have a governor who just really isn't going to make this easy on anyone. And, he's got a lot of policy on his side. And then, we're in the position of looking at what the voters asked us to do. So, we'll see how that turns out.
This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. We're hoping to get your calls at 1-800-399-3566. But first, we're going to be taking a quick break. And when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Husson University, committed to strengthening Maine's future by preparing the business, health, and communication professionals of tomorrow. Husson.edu.
In Texas, a Democratic candidate for Senate is gaining momentum.
I just haven't seen this kind of excitement and energy and willingness to do what it takes in Texas in my life.
Beto O'Rourke has his work cut out for him, but county by county, he's changing that.
Of the 254 counties, we've visited 226 so far. This is 226 today.
The long-shot candidate taking on Republican Senator Ted Cruz this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Luis Alberto Urrea. The son of a Mexican father and American mother, he says he grew up with a border wall in his own family. He's written about doing relief work in the mountainous garbage dumps of Tijuana, where the poor scrape out a living, and he's followed the deadly path of immigrants trying to cross the border. He has a new novel. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7, right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Mal Leary. Today on the program, checking in with two of Maine's legislative leaders. With me in our Augusta studios, Senator Amy Volk and Senator Nate Libby. She's a Republican from Scarborough and is the Assistant Senate Majority Leader. He's a Democrat from Lewiston and is the Assistant Minority Leader. We invite you to join the conversation. Call at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Let's take our first call from Larry in Bangor. He has a question on the number of handicapped parking spaces we have in the state.
Yeah, can you hear me?
You're on, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm an old duffer. I'm over 70, and we have the oldest state in the nation. And as an old duffer, I recognize, because I need them, we don't have enough handicapped parking spaces in various places, at stores, movie theaters, wherever. They don't even have enough handicapped parking spaces at the VA, excuse me, where I'm 100% disabled vet.
Well, that's surprising to me, Larry. I'm going to have to pay more attention, I guess, when I'm in a parking lot. You know, I think the first thing that jumps to my mind is, do we have people who are using, you know, sometimes you get those temporary permits. Are they using those longer than they're supposed to? You know, or do we actually truly have a shortage and we need to take another look? That would be a question for the Transportation Committee, I believe. I don't know if Senator Libby has anything to add.
Well, Larry, where are you calling from? Where do you live?
I live near Bangor. Okay. I'm definitely not temporary. I'm a 100% disabled vet. I also can't wear a seatbelt, for which I have to get a new permit every year because some reason made a law that I don't like the law. I have to have my doctor rewrite a note every year. But in any event, I have no idea if it's temporary people. All I know is when I go to stores, there's not enough handicapped spots. Now, it's not as though I can't walk. I can walk. My problem is I can't get in and out of my car if somebody parks next to me. So even if I park at the end of the parking lot, somehow, some way, somebody always parks next to me. Very frustrating.
We'll definitely look into it, Larry.
Yeah, that does sound frustrating. Sorry about that, but thank you for your service.
Larry, thank you very much for your call to Maine Calling. Let's go to Frederick in Bath. He has a question specifically for Senator Volk, particularly dealing with some of your comments you made earlier about what some other states are doing. Frederick, you're on the air. What is your question for Senator Volk?
Well, good afternoon, Mal and guests. Well, I have a deep concern, of course, with what southern conservative states, and particularly Kansas, has done in depleting their treasury with this fallacious notion that if we deplete our state governments and provide the private sector with more funds, that we're all going to somehow be better off. And that really worries me as far as LD 1781, which would be the giveaway, of course, to General Dynamics via Bath Iron Works of $60 million over the next two decades to a company. General Dynamics certainly does not need $2 million per year from our state treasury. And the condition that we find ourselves in Maine, I'm, of course, very disappointed with my local State Senator Eloise Vitale and State Representative Jennifer DeChant in proposing this, but it's certainly merely being standing the position of General Dynamics, and I'd particularly like to hear both of the state senators response to how can they state that they're being fiscally responsible, but yet thinking about depleting our treasury.
Frederick, let's give Senator Volk a chance to answer that question first.
Sure. So I think what we need to look at is the understanding that we live in a global economy and that Maine is an expensive place to do business, that Bath Iron Works is continually competing against other shipbuilders across the country, particularly down in Mississippi, where many, many of the costs are much lower than they are here in Maine. Some of our programs, Pine Tree Zone, which actually is in the committee that I chair and will be having a work session tomorrow on that issue, is another example of an economic development program that some people feel is unjust, but it was designed essentially to offset the acknowledgement that Maine is an expensive place to do business when you compare us to other states and an expensive place to do business when you compare us internationally. So we have to compensate for that in some way. You know, I think there's a lot of discussion about whether or not it's worth it. You know, what is the return on investment? I think sometimes that's very difficult to quantify, and that's one of the issues we're having with Pine Tree Zone, which actually is evaluated biannually, I believe, by a third-party independent firm that is hired to do just that, that does the same sort of work all across the country and has lots of experience. But it is a challenge. And, you know, I believe that the tax committee is taking a long look at this issue with Bath Iron Works. Previous legislatures obviously felt that it was worth the investment to maintain those jobs in Bath. And all of the spinoff economic development that happens as a result of that. So I guess that's about all I have to say on that subject.
Nate, this has been an issue for the legislature for decades, and that is when you give a tax break to a business, are you getting back something from that mm-hmm. business that helps our economy? Mm-hmm. Are we getting that in all cases, or are we still trying to refine the process?
So over the last few years, one group of legislators on the Government Oversight Committee have been leading the charge in evaluating every single tax break that the state of Maine gives to the business community. We haven't had that before. The idea was that the legislature would pass a tax cut because a certain industry needed it, and there was a promise that jobs would be created and wealth would be generated and that sort of thing. I think now we're looking a little bit more critically at each tax incentive that we have on the books, because if you add them all up, the amount of tax breaks roughly equals the amount of state spending in a particular year. There are some would argue that if you get rid of all the tax breaks, you could cut everybody's taxes in half, and that would be a more fair way to go. I'm not sure if that's totally the case. I tend to agree in some aspects with Senator Volk in that Maine does need to position itself in a competitive way, regionally, nationally, and internationally. If there are opportunities for us to offset some of our more expensive parts of operating a business, whether it's energy costs, workforce development, healthcare, any sort of things along those lines, I think we should look at that. When it comes to Bath Iron Works, I think there's a lot of momentum towards reauthorizing that tax credit because so many jobs and good-paying jobs exist at our small shipyard in Bath. I think if it's looking like this tax credit is going to be reauthorized, I'm very interested in making sure that we have performance standards, clawback provisions, in the event that General Dynamics outperforms what they're saying they will on their balance sheet, that potentially some of those benefits would be returned to the state coffers. If jobs are not created like they said they would, potentially claw back some of those tax benefits. And I think if we are going to pursue extending that tax credit, we should be looking at protecting the rest of Maine taxpayers when we do.
Let's go to George in Waldoboro. He has a question, but he thinks that some of your comments earlier from both of you were saying that the voters didn't understand what they were voting on some of these referenda. George, what's your question for the two lawmakers?
Well, actually, it's a comment, Keith. I've been listening to your show and a previous show you had on in which somebody said, well, you know, the marijuana proponents outspent the marijuana, the other side, by a significant margin, as though that were somehow detrimental, although the Supreme Court says it's not. Also, I've heard politicians stand in front of rows of microphones and say, well, we can't implement ranked choice voting because it's unconstitutional. But then they stop talking, and what they should continue to say is, so Monday I'm introducing an amendment to the Constitution because that's obviously what the voters want. I guess my comment in general is, if any elected employee circumvented, denied, or went around or negated any voter initiative on the ballot that was passed, then they've disqualified themselves from holding public office. That's it.
Amy, would you like to respond to George's comment?
Sure. And I just wanted to point out that we've had the referendum process in Maine for quite some time now. I don't know exactly when it was started, but my understanding is that 70% of the legislation that has been passed by referendum has been changed by the legislature afterward in some way.
Yeah, George, I would say that there were a number of us in the House and Senate just last year when we received the advisory opinion from the Supreme Court on certain aspects of ranked choice that they saw as in conflict with the Constitution. Several of us moved forward almost immediately a amendment to the Constitution. Where it got snagged was that we did not gather the two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate necessary to send that constitutional amendment out to the people. Those of us that support ranked choice voting in the legislature support amending the Constitution, but we have not been able to get to that threshold of two-thirds in the House and Senate to get it out to the people.
You're listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. If you have a question, please call us at 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Patrick and Sacco, who has a question on the marijuana referendum. Patrick, what's your question? Patrick?
Patrick is gone,
I guess. It looks that way. Let's go to Scott in Lewiston, who has a question on medical services. Scott, what's your question, please?
Hi, I'm a 53-year survivor of traumatic brain injury due to surgery for a congenital brain tumor. I've complained about this issue for decades about the Medicaid program. It will pay to remove someone's teeth, but not to maintain them. And there's been proven correlations for years that there is a proven correlation between poor physical health with poor dental health. What is it with a governor who refuses to increase the Medicaid and it allows a wasted fund to remove someone's teeth when it's cheaper to save them?
Amy, let's start with you since the question was pointed to the Republican governor.
Sure.
Medicaid could cover dental services, but that's an extra cost, and Maine has chosen not to make that investment, as I understand it.
And I would just point out that I believe that decision predates Governor LePage. I don't work for Governor LePage, but I just do think I should probably point that out. He's the first Republican governor that we have had since McKernan, and none of the other governors have chosen to expand Medicaid to cover basic dental services either.
Nate, one of your constituents.
Yeah, adult coverage for dental examinations is a perennial issue in the legislature. We often have positive discussions and move the legislation forward, but then it gets to the appropriations table where we make spending decisions, and we were not able to come up with the money to do it. I think it's unfortunate because a lot of us would look at adult dental care as a preventative care. Costs that we incur in the front end would mitigate larger costs down the road when folks have complications. I think a lot of us agree on the policy. It's a matter of trying to find the money to fund it.
Amy?
I'd just like to add that we do have a dental school in the state of Maine now, and you can go to UNE and get really low cost or possibly even free preventative care, as well as any other types of dental care, if you're willing to, you know, take some extra time. I certainly did that back when my kids were really little and our finances were a bit tight. It was, you know, a lot less expensive than paying whatever it was to go to the dentist. That said, my sister's a hygienist, and I have an appointment with her this afternoon, so I'm going directly there from here, so it's a little ironic.
And Scott, I would just say, if you get in touch with my office, we can certainly talk with you about some local dental care providers in Lewiston that I think can probably help you out.
Good idea.
We seem to have many calls from Lewiston today. Jeremy is calling from Lewiston on the problem of substance abuse services. Jeremy, what's your question, please?
Well, my question is, hello, can you hear me?
You're there. Go ahead.
All right. My question is in particular around recovery residences in Maine. I attempted to establish one in the Lewiston area and ran into several zoning issues and things like that. And really what it does is, I'm also a treatment provider in the state of Maine. And one of our biggest concerns is that there is, you know, people come into treatment and they come from particular neighborhoods and, you know, that don't really promote recovery. And then we try to establish them with a sober living environment that's going to be effective for them. And then we run into different requirements from the city that we're in. It's different from city to city. And it's really difficult to, you know, really help somebody and get them on the road to recovery. I guess my question for you is there anything that we can do in the legislature that will promote recovery and things like that, that will, so we can get people safe in living environments?
Yeah, Jeremy, there's a bill pending before us as we speak that would create a licensing system for recovery residences. And my understanding in Lewiston, one of the hang-ups is the city needs to see that license before they'll permit a recovery residence. That's my understanding. I hope I have that right. So I think we have a piece of legislation before us that will help address that concern.
Amy?
Thank you for the work that you do, Jeremy, because it is really important, and you sound like you're a very conscientious treatment professional. Unfortunately, I know for sure that in the Portland area, even though there are a lot of really wonderful recovery residences, there have also been some abuses, as well as many documented in other states. So I support the bill that Senator Libby's talking about. I think it's very important for us to not have too many regulations, because then we're going to do what, and Senator Libby is familiar with this issue, what's happened with the home child care providers, where we've been regulating them right out of business. But we do need to ensure that these are honest people that we're dealing with, that truly are providing the services and not just simply taking advantage of people. We want people to be in recovery. We want people to be successful in recovery. But we don't want this to be a money grab for dishonest folks. So hopefully you will support that legislation and it will pass, and you'll be able to get your permit to operate in Lewiston.
Nate, what's the price tag on this?
I'm not sure.
I wouldn't imagine there'd be that much of a price tag. It's a licensure process. Typically, licenses are covered by the fees. So not sure. It's not my committee. I think it's probably Health and Human Services.
Well, I asked the question because at the end of the session, as you both know, we always have literally hundreds of bills with some price tag that have been passed by the legislature, but then they fail because it's not the funding for them.
Yeah. Right.
I think this one may be a priority of the opiate task force, so that might help improve its chances of being funded.
But you never know about that.
Well, and it just takes us back, I think, to a lot. This issue comes up over and over again. We have a limited amount of money, and we're seeing right now we're in a period of economic recovery, and our revenues are up, and that's largely a result of it's partly at least a result of some of the tax cuts that have happened at the federal level as well as in the state of Maine. We have actually decreased income taxes over the last several years. But we need to make sure that, we fund some of these things in a really careful way. But we also can't take our eye off the ball of we need to also be putting as much money back into the pockets of Mainers as we possibly can, because that just snowballs, has a snowball effect in terms of our economy and the recovery that we really need to continue to see so that we can hold on to all these programs.
This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we take another quick break, a word about tomorrow's show. The Maine Calling team is headed to the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center. Join Jennifer Rooks and her guests for a conversation about the work undertaken at Mount Washington. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Japan, new ways to grow old. With me, Aki Mariama Leggett. Many Japanese people will live to 100, but will we have a good quality of life? So what innovations in housing and care might help us?
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock in just a few minutes from now here on Maine Public Radio.
This Week in This American Life, 5 women.
I'm 8, and I felt like I was going to die if I never met him.
They had, named someone, the hypnotizer. They're like, oh, the hypnotizer. But eventually I found out it was me.
Like, I'm 12, and you're an adult talking about, my body and, boys, and it's so uncomfortable.
We hear the personal histories of 5 women and how those histories affected them when they all came into contact with the same man.
That's coming up this evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. Yes, there is an app for that. For those of you counting on public radio, that is. The Maine Public app allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Classical along with you anywhere and anytime. Stream Maine Public Radio or Classical, or just catch up on the news. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones and tablets, and it also gives you access to many PBS and Maine Public Television programs. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and it's free.
Welcome back. I'm Mal Leary, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, checking in on Maine's legislature. Joining me today, Amy Volk. She's the Assistant Senate Majority Leader and a Republican from Scarborough. Nate Libby is Assistant Minority Leader and is a Democrat from Lewiston. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. We have a question from Bob in South Portland, again on the Bath Iron Works tax break that's pending before the legislature. Bob, what's your comment or question?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. It's a comment that I would appreciate a response from your guest. I have to say I'm quite disappointed as a long-term Maine Public supporter by the lack of coverage on this issue by Maine Public, but I'm particularly disappointed and frankly quite angered that your guests and the rest of the political leadership and frankly many politicians across the state continue to spread falsehoods regarding the fact of this issue, in particular continuing to regurgitate the General Dynamics talking points about competition, job security, is really profoundly dishonest. If anybody spends any time looking at the facts of this, including relative to other shipyards, this is really just a threat that is unfounded, and I just cannot understand why we can't get traction on the truth with this issue.
Nate, why don't you start on this one?
I understand your frustration. The ugly reality, though, is that in the state of Maine, we are deciding our tax policy in relation to the other 49 states. And that applies to every industry that operates here. We're no longer in a 19th century mode of regional localized economies. We are literally competing with the other 49 states and the rest of the world. And I think while I don't necessarily love the idea of extension of the Bath Iron Works tax credit, I also have to be cognizant of what the Bath's competitor in Mississippi is doing. And the amount of public assistance the state of Mississippi is giving to Bath's competitor is astonishing and pales in comparison to the $2 million that the legislature is considering.
Amy?
Sure. So, I was just getting some more detail on this, but Bath Ironworks has an annual payroll of $350 million. They spend annually $45 million with 300 different Maine companies. They employ 5,600 people. at an average salary of $60,820 a year. They've hired 2,000 people since 2014. And just to compare, the average, so the average salary at BIW is $61,000 a year, roughly, and the average salary for the rest of the state is $44,000 a year. So these are really good jobs. Bath Ironworks supports a lot of small businesses that depend upon their being able to supply the shipyard. And, you know, I think there's a pretty strong argument to be made, as Senator Libby just stated, that, you know, what we are offering to them in terms of cost set-offs is pales in comparison to what Mississippi gives their competitor.
Bob, thank you for your question. Let's move on to another call from Lewiston, Nate. You seem to be popular today. Meredith has a question concerning lead poisoning in our low-income housing stock. Meredith, what's your question, please?
Hi, my question is, lead poisoning rates are higher in Androscoggin County, I believe, than for the rest of Maine.
I
wondered what you can tell me about lead poisoning rates and low-income housing and anything on that issue. Thank you.
Yeah, you've got two good people to talk to about this issue. Senator Volk has also been a leader in the legislature on this, but there are tracts of Lewiston neighborhoods that have the highest rates of lead poisoning in the state, and a lot of it has to do with the aging housing stock. Up in Augusta and with our partners locally and partners in the federal government, we've tried to attack the issue from lots of different angles, whether it's direct funding to make repairs to housing stock, whether it's train folks to go out and do lead detection work and lead abatement work. I've been working on a proposal to increase the level of certification for contractors who are working in lead abatement, and then as well changes in our reporting for childhood lead poisoning. All these pieces coming together, we hope to see some reduction in the high level of lead poisoning that's going on in places like Lewiston. I think it's going to take time. I think we're starting to move the needle in the right direction on this issue, but at the same time, it's astonishing that in the year 2018, we're still talking about childhood lead poisoning when we've known about the dangers for more than two generations.
Amy, why do you think it's taken so long to try to tackle this issue? Because I know I've been covering this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with Senator Libby that it is unconscionable that we're continuing to have this discussion. And again, it comes down to money. So I successfully passed the legislation that lowered the threshold at which the blood detection level is flags for an inspection to figure out whether or not the child is being poisoned, you know, in their home. And that has resulted in a major increase in abatement orders. Well, when you have a major increase in abatement orders, you need to find the money to help people pay the bill to abate their properties. And these are mostly low-income dwellings. You know, most of these landlords are not making a killing off running these buildings. So sometimes they may choose to just leave a building vacant rather than pay to abate it. And we know, you know, at the same time, we have a shortage of low-income housing in the state of Maine. So I last year introduced a bond for affordable housing for seniors. And this year, in talking with stakeholders, I asked them if they would go along essentially with asking the Appropriations Committee to adjust that bond to include $5 million in funding for lead abatement, should that bond be passed, as well as dedicating some of that affordable housing to go toward workforce housing, which is, you know, somewhat similar to affordable housing. And because we do have a major shortage, and this is a big concern. I also know that Representative Golden from Lewiston has legislation which we passed out of my committee and that will go to appropriations, but we have earmarked Fund for Healthy Maine dollars to pay for that, and that will help pay for some of the abatement across the state, but, you know, particularly in Lewiston. Lewiston also has a grant that they got from the federal government. You know, all of this is very helpful, but unfortunately, children continue to be poisoned, and where it is a finite problem, and you know, it would be possible, given enough funding, for us to completely eradicate lead. You know, we just have to continue to be committed to finding that funding.
You mentioned the problem of getting another bond through this legislature. It reminds me of our discussion earlier about the number of bills on the appropriations table.
Yep.
I added up over $1 billion in bond requests, of which only a fraction of those can be spent. So isn't that one more major item you've got to get done in the next 6 or 7 weeks?
Yes, it is.
Is set the priorities on borrowing, not just as priorities on spending.
Yeah, over the last 6 or 7 years, we've typically borrowed about $100 million each year to make investments, primarily in roads. I think we're entering a point, though, with stabilized revenues, growing revenues, that the state has a capacity to borrow a little bit more. If you compare Maine to the rest of the other 49 states, we're in the bottom 30% in terms of borrowing on a per capita basis. Holy cow, that's a lot of jargon. But anyway, that's all to say that we borrow very responsibly, and borrowing at low interest for the state to make investments in areas we know we need to invest in, I think is good for the economy. One area that I've been pushing on, and I've actually found an ally in the governor, is around student debt repayment and student debt forgiveness. Student debt in the country is now surpassed credit card debt as the largest form of personal debt that Americans hold. The average in Maine is about $30,000 for a college graduate. So what we're proposing as a workforce attraction tool, as a way to send a message to the other 49 states that Maine is a place to come and set up shop, raise your family, and work, is that if you move to Maine and you participate in the workforce, we'd like to help you pay some of your student debt off, pay it off more quickly, so that it frees up money in your monthly budget to buy a car, start a family, put away for retirement, that sort of thing. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to bring Republicans and Democrats together this year to pass something really big and bold around student debt forgiveness, and I think one way to do that is with a bond.
Let's go to Margaret now from Brunswick. She has a question about child care. Margaret, what's your question, please?
Yes, it's actually more of a comment, but I would like
to hear go ahead.
Response. I'd like to hear a response, please, from Mr. Libby to the comment made by your Republican legislator on the panel there concerning a statement that I believe I heard correctly, that we are regulating home child care providers out of business. It's my understanding as an educator and one who spent years in the early childhood field that those regulations exist to ensure the welfare and safety of our children, and that we have some standards for people who are providing care for them. I think there's a misconception in our society that anyone can care for children, and that's a gross inaccuracy, and I hope that someone, especially Mr. Libby, could speak to that. Thank you very much for your time, and I enjoy your program very much.
Yeah, Margaret, thanks for the comments. I think a lot of us in the legislature would agree that we need to provide a uniform standard for all child care providers, and that, you know, children are an incredibly precious resource who can't always speak up for themselves. So our child care regulations need to be firm and be geared towards safety of children. With all that said, I am noticing from the community that I represent, which is a growing community, the population of young people is growing at a rapid pace, that there are strains on the child care provider market, and there are long wait lists and that sort of thing. I've observed some inconsistent application of current regulations from the LePage administration. I know that's frustrating a lot of child care providers. The providers I've heard from are seeking some modest relief or predictability in that enforcement of regulations, but I don't think any of them are advocating to get rid of the whole book of regulations. I don't think many of us would.
No, certainly not. And I actually have a degree in human development and have raised 4 children myself. So I certainly place the safety of children, very top of the list in terms of child care. But we're talking about a level of micromanagement that has been exhibited at times by the department that has really caused a lot of consternation, I would say, amongst child care providers, particularly home child care providers. And Anecdotally and also statistically, many have thrown up their hands and just gotten out of it altogether. And unfortunately, the center-based care has not been able to make up the difference, particularly when it comes to infant care. Many people, for whatever reason, a variety of reasons perhaps, are more comfortable placing infants in a home setting as opposed to a child care facility setting. And yet, infant care wait lists are lengthy. And that becomes a workforce issue. If people do not have safe places that they're comfortable with and confident in to bring their children, they can't go to work. And, you know, we have a lot of people for whom we would like, low-income people that we would like to see attend skills training or attend community college or, you know, pursue a degree or enter the workforce. And yet there are not enough places that take subsidy for these folks, even though we have plenty of subsidy dollars left, but there just are not the placements for them. So we're trying to find ways to ensure that we have enough spaces so that people who need to go to work and need to put their children in care will have safe areas and spaces to do that in.
We've got a tweet from Bruce, who is taking a little bit of issue with both of you on your comments earlier. He says the money for ranked choice voting and Medicaid expansion are legitimate issues during the campaign, not post-campaign or post-campaign. I think what he's trying to say there is there shouldn't be a debate. They should be funded because the voters voted for them. How do you respond to that, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on his side. I want Medicaid implemented on July 2nd. The governor, according to the law, needs to begin enrolling eligible people in the new expanded Medicaid program on that date. And as I said earlier, we estimate it's going to cost $30 million to cover expansion, a couple million dollars for administration. And the Medicaid account right now has $800 million sitting in it. So the governor has the funds he needs. He can move the funds by executive order, which he has shown he is not afraid to do on thousands of occasions. It's really in his court. The law is clear. The voters are clear. Medicaid expansion should be happening on July 2nd.
Your response to Bruce, Amy?
Sure. I mean, this is not an issue that we necessarily have a whole lot of power over. It's really a decision by the chief executive and his department.
But ranked choice voting, you do have a choice. Is that money going to be appropriated? I think that's what we're hearing from Bruce.
Well, it doesn't sound to me like we're going to have a choice because it does sound as though the primaries are going to have to be conducted by ranked choice. And so we're going to have to fund that because we can't just expect the Secretary of State to do it for nothing. And I'm sure his employees won't be doing it for nothing. So we'll have to find the money.
Yeah, I would agree. I think ranked choice is a bit of a separate issue where it's sort of housed within the Secretary of State's office. I think his budget is much more limited. I don't know that he has the authority for moving money around through executive orders. So I think Senator Volk's right. We got to do something.
Amy, Nate, thank you both for joining us today. Amy Volk is a Republican from Scarborough and is the Assistant Senate Majority Leader. Nate Libby is a Democrat from Lewiston and is the Assistant Minority Leader. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and we had additional technical help from Steve Giscella. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling's produced by Jonathan Smith, Jennifer Rooks, and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the scientific research taking place at Mount Washington. I'm Mal Leary. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.